This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
There is more carbon stored in the soils than in the atmosphere and all living things combined. Can we grab still more carbon from the air and put it in the soil? We go now to New England, to St. Albans, Vermont, to meet Abe Collins. He is co-founder of Carbon Farmers of America. Abe, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Good to be here. The two organizations I'm working with now is New Soil Quantum and the Soil Carbon Coalition.
Tell us about your own roots, Abe. How did you develop your skills in growing soil as well as food?
I was in Arizona during the 1990s and living and working with a Navajo community. And their land was badly degraded, and the young men and women I was working with, it had become very clear to them that the health of their communities was entirely tied to the health of the land. And so we embarked on this journey of trying to understand what was the cause of desertification and how to reverse it. And we did a lot of work with rainwater harvesting, tree planting, gardens, and, you know, opportunistically irrigated agriculture. But there was always this question in the background, and that is, how do the livestock fit in? Because Navajos are pastoralists and, you know, herd sheep and cattle. And the old people had always said to us, when we had big herds and moved in cycles, this land was a sea of grass. And when we were subjected to this forced stock reduction and parked in the same place, the land turned into a desert. And you looked out and you could see that the livestock, where they were grazing, the land looked very poor. There was erosion and so forth. But there was this recurring message from the old people that, hey, when we had big herds and we moved around, things worked. We ran into the work of Alan Savory and his development of holistic management at some point, and he figured out that indeed those old people were right. It isn't the livestock per se that are causing the damage. It's the management, the human management and decision-making that leads to some number of animals parked in a spot. And that was the opposite of how the plants and the animals had co-evolved. So that by changing the management, you could get the landscape working again. You know, mimic the patterns that evolved, let's say, with bison being chased by wolves, where you had high intensity of animals for a short time, you know, exposed to the plants and soils, and then recovery, and just keep doing that. And Savory had figured out, and through trial and error and a lot of practical development, that desertified landscapes could be turned back into healthy land through the planned grazing of livestock. So that was a big starting point for me, and there's just really in the last 100 years especially, there's been dozens of methodologies, approaches, tools developed through which grazing and agricultural management can improve topsoil. And as a farmer myself, when I eventually moved back to Vermont around 2000 and put these ideas into practice, I saw them bear fruit. Soil becoming more fertile quite rapidly, typically using livestock, grazing, and other methods such as physical aeration of soils. But there's so many tools, I won't get into them all. But there is a big arsenal of tools and approaches for agriculture to improve the soil resource.
What kind of operation are you running now?
This is historically a dairy farm, and we've chosen to do custom grazing of beef in the last few years, and that's been an exciting switch because what we discovered through dairy with the frequent monitoring, you know, your daily dipstick monitoring on your bulk tank, we were able to take the lessons we learned about animal performance from dairy and apply it to beef, and we've found that we're able to get very good gains on just grass. And I get a lot of productivity out of the land. And also, we have these instances where we've combined different management and gotten improved soil.
Abe, I did some part-time farming myself. It had to be part-time because nobody could make a living at it where I was. It was kind of old-fashioned with a tractor, a standard plow, discs and all that to break up heavy soil. I did add manure and I grew some cover crops like rye. But was I still losing soil and carbon, do you think?
It's hard for me to say what your outcomes were. There's so many particulars, you know, wherever you may be. But some of the big rules are that soil needs to be covered year-round. And that's one of the basic rules for soil formation that we often see violated with plowed agriculture. So if the soil is covered year-round, and hopefully even green year-round, you know, with living plants, and that may be a perennial base or that may be cover crops. These are some of the conditions, and there's others. for soil formation to occur, you need photosynthesis, the conversion of air and water into sugars, and then you need that covered soil. And then there's a process of humification by microbes where they synthesize organic matter in forms that are, they're all temporary, but some are just temporary even in the terms of 1,000 years. Physical compaction of the soil is often a limiting factor because soils, the organisms in soils, just like you and me, they need air. So it's just another example. But covered soil, physical looseness and air and crumb structure in the soil, the microorganism populations, the conversion of air and water into sugars, and then the resynthesis into humus, broadly defined. These are some of the conditions, and it sounds like you were probably meeting some of those conditions, although in some instances you might have been a few steps forward and one step back.
Well, textbooks tell us it takes nature about 1,000 years to make an inch of soil. How fast could a farmer do it?
I, as much as anyone, want more and more data on this. There are instances, scientifically validated or quantified instances, of fairly more rapid soil formation than 1,000 years to get an inch. One of the practitioners and developers of a method who I'm really inspired by was a guy named P.A. Yeomans. He was an Australian who got into farming and realized that the notion of conserving soil when you had no soil to begin with was not that practical. And what he discovered was that a combination of, in effect, planned grazing, grazing animals at fairly high density, removing them, letting the grasses recover, and physically aerating the soil with a subsoil or plow, he was able to build inches of soil per year. So not 1,000 years to build an inch, but inches per year. And since he developed that in about the mid-1950s, there's been a lot of people around the world who have taken that further and have seen the similar results, and we have too, where you can get many inches of conversion of subsoil to topsoil. So you're taking the mineral, formerly largely inert subsoil, and getting the aerobic biological processes going in them so that you suddenly go from having, let's say, 6 inches of topsoil to, in a matter of a couple of years, a foot of topsoil working.
Tell us about Carbon Farmers of America, would you?
Sure. Carbon Farmers of America was our first try. And that was a group of farmers who said, hey, we're doing these things that are improving soils, and that helps our production, but it's also benefiting society. We were really influenced by one of P.A. Yeoman's sons, Alan Yeoman's, who wrote a book called Priority One. And in it, since the late 80s, he'd written a paper about 1989 entitled An Agricultural Solution to Global Warming. And in it, he did the math, and he found that a few percentage point increase in the organic matter or soil carbon, the equation would work out that that would essentially be extracted from the atmosphere and put into the soil, where you stop having it be in excess in the atmosphere, a pollution problem. And when you have more in the soil, suddenly you have water holding, fertility, you know, plant growing organic matter. So it was based on that notion and the idea of farmers being paid to provide yet another environmental service to the rest of society beyond food production, which would be addressing climate change. And it was early in the game in terms of people understanding soil as an important place for carbon to end up where we need it, and if we get it there, we're extracting it from the air. The business never cash flowed, but it led us to do a lot of thinking and working on this. And carbon trading may be contentious and problematic and too big in some ways to make markets really work. What I think that I personally, you know, my learning curve has been, when you improve soil, a whole bunch of things happen, including regulation of water in a watershed. There are many local benefits to soil formation, and we may do well to kind of bring it closer to home, because when things are at the scale of global agreements and accords and economics, and you have a long time between proposed payments and proposed benefits to society, it makes more sense to bring the markets closer to home. So when we build soil, we can address flooding, drought, wildfire, dust storms, landslides, erosion damage to infrastructure, any number of problems like this, water quality and water quantity, and we can make the water more available. And things like natural hazards mitigation and water issues are very meaningful and carry real economic weight on the watershed scale. So we've moved more towards that, but it does not change our starting assumptions that improving or increasing soil organic matter is really one of the most direct ways to address climate change problems. But it also addresses so many other factors. that mean real things to real people in terms of economics and just basic community security at the local scale.
How did you make out with Hurricane Irene? We're going to have more of these extreme rainfall events. We've just been told that by the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change. So how did it work out for you in New England there when we got all that rain?
Well, here in my town of St. Albans, we had a historically wet spring with flooding everywhere, and then we had a drought that was unprecedented. There was no living memory of a drought this bad. And then it was broken by Irene. For us, we only got 3 1/8 inch from, it was Tropical Storm Irene by the time it got to us. And that broke the drought, which was welcome for us. For my hometown, just a few hours south, it was very hit hard. It was, every road and every bridge was destroyed. People couldn't get in and out of the town. A lot of Vermont suffered badly and had massive damage to infrastructure. One of the things that became clearer was that improved soil health in the state of Vermont could have mitigated some of that damage. The more carbon is in your soils and the better the cover, the more that raindrops soak in, are held, are used for plant growth, gradually trickle down to recharge water tables and come out in springs and streams. We need more healthy soil in Vermont and anywhere to be able to give ourselves the security of against extreme weather events like drought and flooding.
So you have just launched the Vermont Carbon Challenge. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The Soil Carbon Coalition is a nonprofit that myself and Peter Donovan and our good friend who passed away recently, Terry Goffert, we co-founded that about 5 years ago. And one of the notions is that practical farmers and ranchers everywhere are doing management that's improving soil health and providing more environmental services. That is not necessarily what gets into the peer-reviewed journals. And we're looking to, in effect, change the leadership around this conversation of soil health and provision of environmental services by doing practical monitoring of practical farmers wherever the service is desired. So the idea is a challenge to monitor soil carbon on farms and ranches and have those farmers do their management, you know, their real whole farm management with an eye towards soil health improvement, and come back in 3, 6, and 9 years and measure again, monitor again, and see what sort of change has been achieved and look for where are the outliers, where are the anomalies, where's the real progress being made, and be able to correlate that to management. This isn't just something that only the experts can tell us how to do. Practical people farming and ranching on the land have management that's yielding good results, and we're looking to identify that and reward it and have that influence policy.
Most of my listeners are city dwellers. They buy their food in the supermarket. Why should they care about what you are doing? And is there some way that they can relate to this new movement in agriculture?
I think absolutely that the interface between the rest of society and the land are the farmers and grazers. And the people in the cities, they rely on the services that we land managers provide. And I've gone through the list a little bit, but climate regulation, food production, the quality of the food that we put into our bodies, and the environmental services like watershed regulation, mitigation of flooding, drought, wildfire, and so forth. These things really do come from soil health, and it's amazing what a range of goods come from soil, but currently farmers are only paid for the quantity of production. And in a sense, that's a perverse incentive where we get what we're paying for. We're getting drying out aquifers, and we're getting flooding and wildfires and so forth, because the land management is yielding decreasing, you know, every year decreasing soil health. So cities are entirely dependent on the services that come from soil, and thinking about economics in terms of what is it that we want from land managers and how can we set up policy and economics that reward them for improving the soil that give us the security that we need in the cities and the goods and services. It's a good way to begin. So buying from producers who are producing good quality, not only food, but soil, is one way to think about it, but also thinking about the larger economic policies that would reward farmers for increasing their soil organic matter, their soil carbon. And one of the basics of that is you want that pretty much to be based on performance. So that implies soil and landscape monitoring, things like water quality, groundwater levels, soil organic matter levels, things like this.
That's a whole new regime you're proposing and a whole new way of looking at farming, I think, and I hope it succeeds. It must succeed. Can you give us a website or two to follow up?
Let's see. The soilcarboncoalition.org is a great place to start, and managingholes.com and managingholes, W-H-O-L-E-S, is another good place. And I just, you know, want to say that I think you have a payment for ecosystem services trend that's been happening actually for decades and is really gaining momentum these days. And we're seeing more and more proposed schemes, and I say schemes in a not a diabolical sense, but just plans or pilot projects, where cities are working with land managers to incent good land management for the environmental benefits with real economic costs, you know, or benefits to their cities. New York City is one great example where it was either an $8 billion water treatment plant or they improved the health of the upstream watershed, and they achieved the same outcome for about $1.5 billion. There's many instances like this developing, and I think it's a good line of thinking, and we just have to be aware that there's going to be a learning process. But we need what farmers are producing just beyond the food. We need the environmental quality and security that comes from healthy soil.
I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with Abe Collins. Thank you so much, Abe.
Thank you, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.